Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the counterculture in the United States during the 1960s, but before we get started today, I'm going to talk a bit to the teachers that regularly listen to the podcast about a couple of webinars I'm going to be co-hosting later this year with Hodder Education, the new A-level history series that gives teachers some fresh perspectives and new energising ideas for their lessons. Will start on October the 19th with the first webinar. I'm going to be focusing on modern Britain. For those that tuned in last year, I'm sure that you can recall the fun we had. On November the 2nd, I'll be co-hosting with Alf Wilkinson on Soviet Russia, and then on the 9th of November with Richard Kennett, and we'll all be talking about Nazi Germany. Finally, I'm going to be talking with Helen Snelson on November the 16th about post-war Germany from 1945 to 91. So if you're a subscriber to Explaining History, you can get a discount on each booking by following the link that I'm going to put with this podcast and quoting the promotional code WF0009023, which is also listed below. So that's going to save you 10% on the booking costs. So there are benefits to subscribing. Anyway, let's move on from there. So the counterculture of the 1960s is a fascinating phenomenon. There is a question as to whether too much is really made of it, and the counterculture itself is an umbrella term for a wide range of different cultural and political ideas on the left that are in opposition to mainstream thinking. The development of a counterculture in America during the 60s shouldn't be seen as the development of an intellectual or cultural left in America in the 60s. This had long been established. You can look at the development of an anarchist movement in America in the 19th century. A really good book on that is Alex Butterworth's The World That Never Was. And there is a close relationship between the anarchist movement in America and that in Europe. There was a real rich exchange and kind of interflow of ideas. And there had been, in the aftermath of the First World War, the interwar years, a very strong communist and fellow traveller movement in America. Now, if you've listened to my Fellow Travellers podcast, the Fellow Travellers were members of the liberal left who didn't necessarily advocate a communist future for the United States of America, but certainly had huge sympathies for and admiration for the Soviet Union. There was a small but quite robust Trotskyist movement in America too. Trotsky, in his exile in Mexico, was largely surrounded by American students and activists, many of a rather unfortunately impressionable nature, and he relied mainly on American benefactors in his later years. The journalist Frieda Kirchwey, who later became editor of The Nation, was one of the first kind of liberal, left end of the liberal elite, who found a fascination with Trotsky And there were a variety of causes, inequalities, injustices in the 20s and 30s that brought people into the kind of the milieu and the discourses of the left, civil rights, female emancipation, and the plight of minorities, particularly, created a small but not insignificant base for the liberal intellectual left. The working class unionised left actually tend not to be part of the what later emerges as a counterculture. These are, if anything, quite conservative with a small c. And whilst they protect the rights of working people and ensure that union members are well looked after, or as well looked after as can be fought for, the penetration of politically and culturally revolutionary ideas into the union movement in America is pretty limited, and even more so during the 1960s under the conditions of the Cold War. So why is it we see this transformation from one kind of left to another by the early 1960s? And well, the answer is Stalinism. The arguments that were put forward in America and to a greater extent in Europe as well, that were sympathetic towards Stalinism in the 1930s, that saw it as a bulwark against Nazism, that during the 1930s it was the only economic force capable of really righting the world from the Great Depression, all these kinds of things, the ideas that it represented modernity and progress. There is, after the Khrushchev's secret speech and after the crushing of the Hungarian uprising, there is virtually nothing left in these arguments. They have no broad appeal within Europe. They are in tatters, and the European and American communist parties see huge droves of young people abandoning them, and older people as well for that matter. The Cold War and the period of McCarthyism had done immense damage to the Communist Party of the USA, and the left was in a particularly parlous state after the period of the McCarthyist witch hunts and the Red Scare. For the critics of the developing counterculture in the 1960s, it was derided as a decade of lazy thought, intellectual posturing that produced very little in terms of concrete political ideas, and was really the means by which radical politics justified a new sense of exhibitionism and consumption. The generation growing up in the mid-1960s who had moved to the left, who entertained revolutionary or anarchic ideas, and who blended those with New Age ideas, you know, Carlos Castaneda and that sort of thing, or looked to the East, to Buddhism and Hinduism. These were a generation that grew up in an age of material abundance, the likes of which their parents, who may have been on an older, more traditional left trajectory, had never experienced. This was a generation, whilst they perhaps were loath to admit it, of hyper-consumerists. They purchased vehicles and clothes and music and the fashions of the era in a way that their parents, who had lived through the Great Depression, would probably never have dreamt of. And part of the excess of the 1960s was appalling to a generation that had grown up not just with privation of the 1930s, but also with the strict discipline and service mentality and patriotism and conformity that the war brought. In a way, I guess this podcast is a continuation of last week's on Barry Goldwater, because it shows how a society with a fair degree of consensus throughout the post-war years was starting to fragment in the mid-1960s, and how polarisation, cultural and ideological polarisation, was starting to occur. The what we would think of as hippies, again, a hugely contested term, one which I'm not massively comfortable with, on the TV screens in the late 1960s, who represented a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of America's youth, and certainly a small minority of the kind of countercultural movement, became synonymous in the ideas of people with conservative views as evidence that something terrible had happened to America in the 1960s, something inexplicably bad, and much of what has happened in American discourse from the 60s onwards has been an attempt, the conservative American discourse anyway, has been an attempt to try to explain this phenomena of why long-haired youth took LSD and entertained these seemingly unpatriotic notions while America was fighting in Vietnam. And it's probably got a lot to do with the fact that there were the opportunities to do these kinds of things, that affluence and education had afforded the counterculture its ability to exist at all. What both seemed to be doing was kind of accelerating the pace of cultural and intellectual change in the 1960s. And that combined with a very, very tumultuous period of crisis, really, as far as the civil rights movement went and the impact of the Cold War on America, and later the impact of the Vietnam War on America. You have this very rich, fertile kind of historical landscape for radical intellectual and cultural and social movements to develop in. Late 50s and early 60s activism had been tended to be largely statist. The optimism of that was palpable in 1960 with the inauguration of John F. Kennedy, the development of things like the Peace Corps, and a belief that a faith in the state as a progressive vehicle for social change, particularly under sort of young white Americans, is replaced in the later 60s with a general suspicion of the state, a belief that the state is part of a wider system of rule, a kind of a class rule, with the government and American corporate power being largely interchangeable and kind of having all sorts of complex and secret relationships with one another, along with the organs of state power such as the Department of Defense and the CIA. Led many members of the counterculture, instead of embracing the kind of the spirit of Kennedy, to be profoundly suspicious of it, and the radical critiques of the society that were coming from new left figures such as Herbert Marcuse during the 1960s, you know, helped to reinforce this view. By the way, if you want to find out about Marcuse, go back to my Frankfurt School podcast, and he's featured in there. So what the 60s become, partly as a result of the counterculture and what it signifies, the 60s have become this incredibly important and interesting decade, particularly America's 1960s, and it becomes a point of reference for people in many, many years afterwards to return to and to reevaluate, to question, to challenge, to wonder whether this was a turning point in America for decades to come. And people mentally navigate around the 1960s, interpreting it for both good and ill. The counterculture is synonymous not just with the hippie movement, but with the development of the new left. The Students for a Democratic Society, particularly, and the Youth International Party later on, were the result of this process that I've already mentioned of the left rejecting Stalinism and the left rejecting really the legacy of Lenin as well. Interestingly, at this period of time, Mao is not reviled or rejected, and for some, he's seen as, you know, the answer. A great deal of New Left thinking comes from the critiques on the left of both Stalinism and neoliberal capitalism, such as the Frankfurt School, the Frankfurt School's various critiques, and the question of you know, how it is that something revolutionary, something supposed to be emancipatory, had become so monstrously authoritarianism. And later, you can see a lot of this in Chomsky's thinking, who, you know, he emerges as a vocal critic of the government in the 1970s. He's...
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One of the first, kind of the original Vietnam protest generation. And in his book Chomsky on Power, he says that ultimately capitalism and Soviet communism have a lot in common because they are both systems of power. And you find that the people at the top can very easily, if they need to, transition between different ideological positions as long as power is the power goes unaffected, and it's that which they're particularly interested in. And there is some evidence to suggest this. You can see amongst the Bush neocons a number of former Trotskyites, and also the former Soviet Union, the, you know, various KGB apparatchiks and party members found no problem in embracing capitalism after 1989. In a way, it's got less to do with the compellingness of the critique. It's got less to do with the kind of the skillfulness of the argument, and more to do with the historical circumstances as existed in the mid-1960s. If one wished to be a progressive dissenting figure, if one wished to protest against war, against racism, against sexism and homophobia, against poverty, and against the inroads into the environment that American corporate power seemed to be making, it wasn't enough really to simply embrace its antithesis in the Soviet Union and Soviet communism. So this is really the development of the New Left has got a lot more to do with the failings of the Soviet system than it has to do with the crises of capitalism, though there were plenty of those afoot in the mid-1960s as well. One of the incubators of the New Left is the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement, which incorporated mainly black activists, but white activists and other ethnic minorities, was an example of idealism, rights consciousness, egalitarianism, and it was an open space where these ideas could be freely expressed and reflected for the most part to other like-minded individuals. Interestingly, Martin Luther King, by 1968, and this perhaps has some reason to do with him being assassinated, had moved to the left. He was looking at wider questions of capitalism. He was wondering whether the oppression of black people was in fact actually embedded, written into American capitalism. And obviously he doesn't get to continue that. But and it's not to suggest that everybody within the civil rights movement moved to the left. That's certainly not the case. there were some alumni from the civil rights movement who were clearly on the economic right by the time the 1980s had come around. But there were significant numbers of people who had transitioned from civil rights through a kind of a political process, and you can imagine that marching for civil rights and being battered by policemen in the Deep South is an intensely and inherently politicising process. And the answers that they came to, the conclusions that they came to, was that this was a question of capitalism itself. There's an important and interesting way. I saw this depicted some time ago in Mad Men, of all things. And it's a TV show that is magnificent for its subtlety, for its ways of showing instead of telling, for hinting and implying instead of shouting. And in, I forget which season it was, the advertising agency run by Donald Draper suddenly has an influx of young people, of people in their 20s. And the clients to the agency, baked bean manufacturers and car manufacturers and this kind of thing, keep saying to Donald Draper and Roger Sterling, these men of the 40s and 50s, 1940s and 50s that is, that they want to know what young people think, what the youth is saying. And in about 1964, this culture, for want of a better word, had infiltrated television, radio, literature, advertising, and consumerism wholesale. And it was kind of presented as the inanity it is, that all of a sudden young people have something more important and interesting to say than anybody else. This is kind of at the heart of some of the presumptions of the counterculture, that the old men of the Cold War really didn't have anything worth listening to, and it was young people that would know and have the answers, and their dynamism and energy would push forth. But the commercial realities of America at the same time, which kind of mirror this, is that there are a lot of young people. There are a lot of young people with lots of consumer power. And advertisers were aware of this, and they knew that it was young people that were likely to buy and spend more. And so the culture of young people, to put it in that very crude terminology, a youth culture, really accelerates in the mid-1960s. And there are nods within mainstream culture made towards the counterculture and rebellion. You know, there's the odd protest song by Bob Dylan or Peter, Paul and Mary that make it into the charts. Films by the end of the decade, such as Easy Rider, which were considered shocking and outrageous, but which attracted huge audiences, again, seemed to echo that something was happening, something widespread and important was happening in the way that young people in America were thinking. And in many instances, many aspects of the kind of the cultural manifestation of the counterculture, we're not talking about explicit politicised manifestos, but really notions of freedom and freedom from the law, from the state, and from parental control that had kind of always existed in American culture. I mean, go listen to what I said last week about Barry Goldwater. He was talking about libertarianism and freedom really from a conservative perspective. I mean, he certainly was no hippie and would have had no truck with the anti-Vietnam War movement. But again, there is manifestations of this desire for freedom within American culture, however it is articulated. That's not to suggest that this isn't an aspiration held by many people around the world, but it particularly is a recurring one within American discourse. On the subject of the political, in 1962, the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, create the Port Huron Statement, which is the kind of the great manifesto of the counterculture. Now, if you're writing an essay on the counterculture, it's worth, if you Google Port Huron Statement, you'll find it. It's out there. It's all over the internet. And it is the kind of the articulation. It's very quite rambly, and there's lots of kind of contradictory and diverse bits to it. But it's the articulation of the counterculture's goals, or the counterculture's politicised goals, as the SDS saw them. But an awful lot of further radical manifestos, and the 60s is littered with them, draw on the Port Huron statement rather a lot. I suppose one of the ironies of the counterculture is that when it really gets going, after Kennedy's death, you know, the 64 to 70, the number of social reforms introduced by Lyndon Johnson, the War on Poverty, the Great Society, federal aid for education, Medicare for the aged, reforming immigration law, the creation of the National Endowment for Arts and the Humanities, and two historic civil rights laws in 1964 and 1965, you couldn't have hoped for a period of greater progressive measures domestically. And perhaps one of the explanations for the counterculture in that period is that it doesn't exist in a time of particular conservative, with a small c, ascendancy. It exists in a time of reform, and there's nothing like a few reforms to really kind of open the floodgates to ambitions and demands for further reform, and taking the pace of reform faster than it can logically go. What you have here as well isn't a kind of a core political party, though there are things like the SDS and the Youth International Party. Instead, you have a movement that is very diverse, very disparate, often very localised in its and parochial, looking for change in particular parts of the USA. A lot of it is kind of united by a kind of cultural norms, you know, music, sexuality, drug use. Around the fringes of the movement, it overlaps with other movements such as the women's movement and the civil rights movement. But actually, I think that the movement for female emancipation in America is actually a kind of a thing unto itself. I mean, for example, writers like Betty Friedan, who wrote The Feminine Mystique, and Helen Gurley Brown, who wrote Sex and the Single Girl, these aren't countercultural figures. These are dissenting figures against a patriarchy, but really quite with conservative figures. They are, for the most, openly discussing ideas about female sexuality for the first time, but they are not, you know, smoking joints and waving placards around and saying down with Nixon. They're not. Now, the counterculture by the end of the 1960s is being blamed for all sorts of stuff, from lawlessness and drug use through to the Manson family murders, of which it's largely blameless. Crime and urban disorder are in some ways, I mean, this is again more one for criminologists or sociologists. I gotta say, I don't fully understand the science behind it, but it seems to be more to do with the development of urbanisation and population shifts and social mobility and all that kind of stuff. And it just happens to have overlapped with a period of immense social tension in America. But it's also interesting to note how many members of the counterculture seemed to exit it once the 60s were over. Figures such as Jerry Rubin from the Youth International Party, who went on to become part of among other things, the self-help movement and the human potential movement, which were the kind of the beginnings of modern self-help culture as we understand it now, and kind of melded with Californian New Age culture, and a way of, for some, becoming exceedingly wealthy. And it's also important to note the extent to which the counterculture's influence is limited. It is the majority of Americans do not experience these things in the 1960s. The majority of Americans do not access marijuana in the 1960s, go on anti-Vietnam War marches, grow their hair, listen to Jefferson Airplane or The Grateful Dead. The majority of Americans in the 1960s live relatively conservative and relatively, for want of a better word, normal everyday mainstream existences, and a great many, particularly white Americans, enjoy the comforts of suburbia and the growing prosperity that only starts to really be derailed after about 1968. And it's always in the decades. If you have a decade of immense cultural and social change, it's always the decades after that that you really see it manifest itself. Kind of the 60s aren't the 60s really until the mid-1970s. And the changes in sort of sexual politics that develop in the 1970s. You only really come of age in the 80s and 90s, I think. So I think what we've got to do as historians is look with critical eyes at the things that TV presents, or you know, films like Forrest Gump present to us in simple and lurid terms, the counterculture very often in what we think it is. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and if you can, support the crowdfunder campaign we're doing at the moment, just to pay for the hosting and to make sure I can continue sending these podcasts out. I'll put the link under this podcast as well. So remember, if you are in teaching and you want to attend some of the webinars I'm doing later in the year, check out the link and hopefully I'll get to speak to you then. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.